Hello and welcome to the 377th episode of the Crate and Crowbar, a podcast about PC gaming. It is the 6th of August. That is the month. Time's strange. When we're recording this, I'm Alex Wiltshire, and tonight I'm joined by Tom Senior.
Hello.
Hello, Tom. It's just us two tonight.
It's just us two. But
that's good.
I'm plump and full intimate. Of bants. Ready to pot.
You've brought your best bant game.
I've been fastened up on playing lots of games. It's been good.
I've not been playing that many games, so I'm glad I want to hear about all your games. But did you see the news today that Black Ops Cold Wars has announced its Season 5 update and that it's going to come with a new mode called Double Agent, which is basically Among Us, but in COD, which is completely that's happening. Of course it is. But at the same time, how?
Yeah, so I think this sort of, the idea of Among Us, remember the ship where it was just a bunch of people in a multiplayer environment and, you know, they'd have ulterior motives, and if someone happened to be in a room with another person they need to assassinate, they'd try and quietly off them. So that's basically Among Us, right? This idea has been around for ages and ages and ages. I wonder why, like, suddenly this kind of cute, top-down, cartoony take on it as sort of, Activision Studios saw that and thought, yep, put a submachine gun or five in that, and we've got a game mode. How could it possibly work in Call of Duty?
I get the feeling that really what happened was that somebody at Activision saw the big numbers and the two words Among Us and said, put Among Us in Call of Duty without thinking anything about what it actually is.
When you say put Among Us in Call of Duty, do you mean like, is it actually a mode that kind of emulates the backstabbing nature of that, or is it just sort of giant kind of butt plug men?
So you have a team of 10, or is a group of 10 people. In that team are three randomly selected double agents, and there is one investigator. The investigator has to figure out by talking to the other players. I mean, everybody loves to talk to other players in a Call of Duty game. I've always seen it as a game about communication and, fellowship.
So he shoots the bullets at him to communicate with his... and then they shoot them back to... And then...
Last one standing is the winner.
Is guilty or not guilty.
Yeah. I don't know. So the double agents are planting bombs. And they're also killing others. I don't really understand, maybe you get points for both, or I don't know what. But essentially, that's their kind of task. I guess everybody who's not them and the investigator is just trying to survive, and the investigator is just alone. I don't know what. So, Among Us, what weapon do you have? Does everybody have the capacity to kill each other? And what is the nature of their weaponry? I've never played it.
So all I know about Among Us is about 90 minutes I've played is a first team bonding exercise in my new job, which is an amazing way to make friends. all I know is that I think you can, if you're the bad guys, you can stab other people.
Okay.
And you want to choose to do that in a room where no one else is. I think that's the thing. I can't at all imagine how it would fit into Call of Duty, but I'm really curious. And also, delighted that, shooters are kind of looking further afield for ideas as well.
Yeah, oh, definitely, definitely. I do, and also what happens when you do a social game and put guns in everybody's hands in an environment where people are conditioned to just immediately shoot anyone they see?
Well, everyone immediately shows tremendous restraint. And I mean, it's the old, especially in first-person shooters for some reason, or first-person games. It's the old Skyrim thing of jumping up on the table and just kicking everything over just because everything's kind of a toy. So there's no kind of verisimilitude to the universe, to me, in first-person games. For some reason, I show more respect to the environment in something like The Witcher 3 than I would in, especially in a Call of Duty kind of I mean, are they going to be set in the actual kind of deathmatch maps where people would otherwise be just opportunistically shooting each other from corners?
Yeah.
I'm so curious about it.
So another little detail I have gathered is that the investigator can see the footprints of an attacker when investigating a dead body.
Oh.
But presumably you're going to be watching your back all the time because of those three other players who are the double agents.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to work with... I don't know, this is coming together. So you're going to have to work with the other players, like, and pick and trust players that will watch your back as you're investigating bodies. And if you're one of the double agents, you're going to want to kind of inveigle yourself in.
Mm.
Presumably you can assassinate the investigator, and that's like mega win, presumably.
Sure, it's quite easy though, isn't it, to do that?
Yeah, you think? you just play Call of Duty and then you win.
One guy falls under the map, sniping up through all the walls.
But you're right about the idea that kind of this is sort of, it's really nice to see, especially these kind of super mainstream first-person shooters trying out these new ideas. Like we were talking a few weeks ago about kind of what will the next Battlefield kind of do? What will the next? And kind of, I think even one of us, probably Graham, said, you know, he's just waiting for the first Among Us in a couple of Call of Duty years.
That was a good shout.
And here it is.
I think I remember Graham saying that I think one of the new Battlefield modes is kind of like a mashup of old, new units and troops and guns and weapons in a kind of just kind of free-for-all, everyone have fun with the toys kind of mode, rather than kind of sticking too closely. I mean, I'm sure a lot of the game will stick closely to a particular theme and aesthetic. But I think we were talking also before about how especially these strongly militaristic games, how can they break out of that and do what Fortnite's able to do to capture the imagination and of a lot of people who wouldn't ordinarily be used to that kind of aesthetic. It's potentially really cool. And I think like maybe you'd look at something like GTA Online, where GTA 5 is just this incredible version of that city, but then GTA Online is a total nonsense playground where people have races in the sky and... unfortunately, hacking is rampant, but that's also kind of hilarious as well. So, it kind of, and that's had a huge ongoing audience. So maybe just embrace the nonsense. There is no reason.
Embrace the nonsense.
But, yeah, embrace it. It's great.
So, what games are you playing, Tom?
Well, recently, I've a new PC for a bit, and not much has kind of like pushed it as much as this game. Not pushed it, but like kind of dazzled me as much as this game. And this is a kind of top-down action game. And imagine in the future, like everyone lived in a giant tower and all the rich people were at the top and all the kind of mutants and downtrodden were at the bottom. And you went up and there was lots of gunfights and things, like every cyberpunk universe. This one's called The Ascent. And it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah,
it's absolutely.
It really is.
It's just the amount of detail in it. The coloured lighting, but the way it has volume and just dynamically ripples across these intensely detailed, just littered streets that are also semi-reflective, as though everything is damp from rain that could probably never even reach this far down into the hive.
Yeah, I'm counting it as condensation.
Yeah, or just kind of sewage leakage. It's that kind of world where everyone. Lives
it's upstairs, kind of just leaking down on you all day.
Yeah,
long.
All of their gunk is just kind of pooling around your feet, and everyone lives in that dreck, and everyone is kind of an asshole because that's what everyone's like in the future. And one of the main guys who's kind of giving you jobs from the start of the game, I'm only like about 3-4 hours in. He's almost kind of like, what do you call it in the US in particular, like people who just look after a block, not a block, but a housing.
Oh, well, yeah. What are they called? They call it the super.
The super. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah.
I believe they call it the super.
Maybe, yeah, it's the super over there, over the pond. And they kind of.
There's a concierge.
there's an amazing.
The butler.
There's a really good This American Life episode called Petty Tyrants. And one of those stories is about a super who just kind of exercises this tyranny in this small empire that he builds. And The Ascent is very much kind of like that. where the supers who look after the Habs are kind of they're kind of sods, but they're your sods because they ultimately keep the food gunk pooling in your sink, so you can scoop them into your open, desperate mouth. And in return, they just fight for their territory and protect people from the attention of the, you know, really dangerous corporations that really run things. Anyway, all of this is just beautiful, beautiful set dressing for what's quite a straightforward twin stick shooter, really. And yeah. I think it most closely, in terms of modern releases, probably kind of resembles Hades a bit. But I would say instead of Hades' beautifully designed, relatively narrow set of tools that have been really like, sort of tested and developed, and each of them is just perfect and beautiful to play with, like the bow or the sword. Instead, this is more of a kind of Diablo-style loot system where loot drops and you equip it, and you change your character build according to the vagaries of the stuff that you pick up. Nonetheless, it does manage to be very satisfying as a run-and-gun game, I think. Partly down to just those incredible visuals, audio visuals as well. It sounds incredible too. And it has these beautiful moments where as you're walking down a gantry to the next area, the camera might dip down and offer you a slightly wider view of the landscape. And you just see these towers, just apparently infinite detail stretching off into the distance as some police chase happens, in the haze, this flying car chasing down some scumbags. And then one of them crashes and explodes. These little dramas always playing out in the background. And it's an extraordinary trip, except I really wish I could turn around in combat. So you can have this fixed viewpoint, and you can, and the great thing about it is that you can see all the way upwards from that. But what if enemies came from everywhere, and a lot of them came from behind the camera view?
There's the bottom of the screen.
Bottom of the screen.
That's the kind of like blind spot.
It's a whole blind zone where stuff can come from. And you can hold down the right mouse button, and that kind of raises the gun. That lets you shoot above humps. So it's a way you can take cover and shoot over. It's quite, works quite elegantly. You've got a really, really bright laser sight, so you can really see exactly where you're going to hit. Though that does sort of, there's a little bit of randomization to hitting, which can be slightly weird. But sometimes, if the enemies are coming from behind me, looking at my monitor, I feel really disadvantaged because of that tilted viewpoint. And it's just little things like that that kind of really start to niggle after a few hours for me. And especially when I kind of, I found like one really cool gun in a building that was, replaced my pistol. It was basically the size of a shotgun, and it shot flame rounds. And it's like, wow, this is a really cool toy. That's happened like once in 4 hours. I think the loot pool needs to be more exciting for me.
I don't think there is a loot pool in the same way that
it's not randomized, really.
There is. I don't think you get randomized weapons like in
because you can Diablo upgrade them, can't you? You can sort of, I guess you find them and then you can buy them pretty much like at the same rate you find them. But everything is really expensive in the game, which I actually quite like, because I think that sort of money in games is often just too plentiful and meaningless, whereas in this, like, you really have to save up for stuff. I feel its limitations. Once I've kind of gotten past the glitz of it, I feel its limitations as a RPG almost. I don't think it really wants to be like a mega number crunching game, but at the same time, I want to find more exciting stuff. I want to gain more exciting
abilities.
I
think it does, because because there are a lot of stats going on, because there are all the different damage types you can put out. When you get a new piece of armor and you look at all the stats, and one piece of armor is 0000000, but then there's an icon that you've never seen before and it's 20 in that. And you know that, well, it's got to be good against that attack, whatever that is. and then you get another one, and it's sort of like nothing in that, but it's got all this stuff in these other ones. And it's definitely suggesting that there's an element of play where you are expected to kind of kit out for certain situations. But I think I've only come across one kind of non-evidently. Okay, I've got one gun that is a fire flame pistol, which is very good. Sets stuff on fire.
Mm.
I've got a digital shotgun.
Cool.
I don't know what why. Shoots good against. Just
fires really shit hot Twitter posts at people and they explode.
Shoots memes at people.
Worst way to die.
Yeah. but against me, I think there was one weapon that kind of like there was a bolt that kind of zipped around with blue light. Well, cool. I don't know what that was, electrical or something. But that's the first time, and I've played it. Yeah, I think I'm probably similar for you, like maybe 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah. So
there's a whole load of numbers and statuses and stuff in it that I don't know what's going on there.
Maybe I'm just too lazy to investigate them.
I think I'm also lazy because I can't be bothered to.
I figured out that if you press D or something in the menus, it replaces all the symbols with a word, but it doesn't necessarily actually explain what it is.
The symbols really aren't very well, you know, because there are lots of really familiar concepts, like the weapons, you know, there's like stuff like clip size and reload time, DPS, and the icons just like, oh, okay, those three vertical lines, that's the clip size. I see.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's like, this Aragonian is this oval perhaps means that I do more fire damage to blob enemies, or yeah, it's hard to pass all that stuff. And also because I find myself putting stat points into stuff that makes it into a game that perhaps it isn't really trying to be. So I put loads of points into recharging the dash move, which is kind of a dodge roll, because I kind of want to just roll around.
Which stat is that?
I think you'll find it's the spiral with the devil's head in it. I don't know. I couldn't tell you by looking at it.
Is it evasion? Because
I think it's evasion. I did look it up. I looked it up at one point, and I think there is one that does that. There's also one that increases your reload speed, which seems essential to me.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, that's good.
Because
I put crit rate up as well.
Crit rate's nice, and it's a lot of it is again about kind of backpedaling while shooting up people who are kind of quite slowly charging towards your face. There's a really weird enemy type where they just they have katanas and they just walk towards you.
Oh right.
Yeah, and I don't know whether it's intentional or not. And they, I was kind of going through an airport baggage area, and all these men with katanas are just walking at me with no shields. It's like, well, an atrocity is about to happen here.
Feel like Indiana Jones. Oh, go on, sorry.
There's actually some really sort of. There's a really nice sort of mission-y bits. There's a bit going into that airport. There's a bit where you sort of end up on a docked ship that you're hunting down some sort of criminal that's fallen out of favor with your super. And fighting into that place and down into that ship is actually really cool. I do think the sense of place adds a lot to it and sort of differentiates it up from a lot of other games that are quite similar.
Yeah,
but it does carry it as well a bit. I don't know.
I'm really surprised because it opens in. Basically the sewer level, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
In this kind of winding passages. And I was thinking, oh no.
Is it all this? Yeah.
Yeah. But then you get into the kind of the hub city and luckily, I was feeling a bit overwhelmed by it because it's just sprawling, winding passageways. And I was thinking how, like at multiple levels, it seems as well, rampways going up, kind of lifts and things.
Yeah.
I was thinking, God, if this is the, you know, there are all these shops as well, some of which you could just go in and they're not, you know, a named shop, but there's people evidently there. Things going on. How am I going to deal with this for the rest of the game? But it seems to be well enough designed that, yeah, it has that sense of hugeness, but actually you can zip across it reasonably quickly. But it's a real, like, fucking hell. I've never really been in a city in a game like this before.
No, it just feels like so full of bespoke detail. You know that thing that which I used to with repeated assets in games, and of course, like if you're at the sewer level, a lot of it does look the same. It is beautifully lit and really detailed, but it's all the same gantry ways and that kind of stuff. But when you're in anywhere remotely populated, which is actually most of the space, there are just like so many different shop fronts or different variations of shop fronts. So I tweeted out one of my favourite shops, which is called Clone, which is loads of zeros in it. Actually, like, you notice that that's actually just a brand in the universe that you see all around the place, but they haven't just, like, taken the shop front and copied or pasted it all around. There's one bit where I was just, like, looking out over this the landscape in the distance, and there was a clone tower, and it was its own separately different design.
That's good.
It was like, wow, you actually gone to the, you know, a good universe building, just have this persistent business running through, but also you've actually created all these different assets to support it, and almost no one will notice unless you're me. But I think there's just something for everyone there. Like, I don't know whether it's they've done this with shaders, but this brilliant technology where all windows need to have depth and rooms behind them.
Yeah.
As you move past them, they shift convincingly. And I mean, I doubt it's actually kind of fully modeled terrain in there that they've created. Probably is some shader magic, but it still creates this, especially with the perspective moving across it from that isometric angle. There's a tremendous sense of depth to everything, which is kind of amazing, because I mean Diablo 3 tried to do this by having you occasionally walk over a bridge where they could then show you a battlefield behind it. This is that to the like 10 times the execution.
Yeah.
And for that, it's kind of changed my idea of what a game with this perspective even can show you. You know what I mean? Like, I will expect more of games like this in the future because I've played The Ascent. And I don't feel like I could say that about a huge number of games that kind of push the graphical side of things and make that a selling point. It does feel like this has actually added something to that genre.
Yeah, definitely. I think that also, you know, it does, like you were sort of saying, that sort of it satisfies different people. Oh, by the way, that shader effect for in putting rooms in buildings is called interior mapping.
Ooh,
nice. That's very clever. Yeah, like it's the combat also feels very, I felt skillful and stylish in it in a way that I haven't typically done in Diablo. Mm. Like Diablo, the sense of skill often comes with, you can feel skillful in Diablo, but it's a different kind of skill where Diablo, like you feel skillful because you've built like a killing machine. Yeah. And you're just walking like this snowball through just bodies. Sometimes you have to do a bit of kind of, you know, skillful sort of use of actions and, you know, abilities and things. But in general, yeah, like it's all about the build. Whereas this, like, you can just feel so stylish where my new flame pistol, just one-shotting enemies running into me because, you know, and just picking the right target, dealing with it, rolling out the way, dealing with another one, which kind of, I was really worried that like the design would be just a running backwards game. there was something that back when the remake of Doom came out, when I talked to a couple of the developers about the design of the takedowns, you know, the takedown kills. What are they called?
I know what you mean. The finisher ones.
The cool finishers. Yeah. And how that came, and a lot of the combat design in the Doom, in the new Doom game was about trying to not be a game about just running backwards and firing all you can as kind of enemies close in on you, which I think is often what happens in horde-based games. And giving you all these reasons to have to push forward because you've got to go in to do the finisher, you've got to go in to get the loot, you know, the kind of ammo drop that you managed to kind of score, but then you massively power up all the weapons in order for that to be possible and so on. Like, it's really clever.
Yeah.
But I was really worried that this game, which has come from a studio, I don't know who they are, come out of nowhere, like it's, you know, from a sort of mid-core kind of Curve, you know.
Yeah, so the
good publisher, but like they're not like EA or something that's right. Going to put like $500 million into it. You know, is it going to be ultimately a game over the tens of hours about running backwards? And sometimes it is, but like most of the time it's not, and that was a real relief.
Yeah, I do like the cover system. I think thing I've sort of realized actually based on what you said about Diablo there, it's almost as though you build the character and then the character acts out its own fantasy. Like it becomes an archetype. It becomes the archetypal necromancer or the archetypal wizard that sets everything with laser beams. Where the grittiness of just being a dude with a gun in a hive city, kind of like you're never going to be that special. You're never going to be this special high fantasy hero. You're going to have to hide behind stuff. You're going to have to dodge roll improbable distances.
scrap it out.
Yeah. It does feel scrappy, actually. I do quite like that. A lot of
It's total chaos sometimes.
Really is, yeah. And
especially when you're doing it in a kind of built up area and all these there are kind of NPCs running around and like they, and you're, I don't want to shoot them, and then you just never mind, they got in the way.
Really, really try not to hit them, but then you just accidentally completely chunk one. Try to take out a robot samurai across the screen. It's just, oh no. Then some explosive barrel goes off and it's just, oh my God.
The explosive barrels are good too. Oh,
it's got this beautiful sense of chaotic close combat gunfire where almost everything is a trace around. Everything is just flares massively across the screen. So you get this like zipping sense of like deathly chaos happening when a firefight breaks out. I think most of the enemies are kind of like there's some weirdly dumb enemy behavior, I think, but there are some of them believably like take cover and will kind of wait until you're out of ammo before they'll kind of pop out and start marching towards you and kind of stuff, which is nice to see. I've yet to encounter many bosses. The one boss I did face was a giant mechy thing. And I did actually just backpedal shooting it for about 5 minutes was the extent of the strategy of it.
So I think I've done, I mean, I suppose it was more of a midi boss. It feels like I've not come across any. So I don't think this is a spoilery, just to say the area I went to, just to see whether, I don't know, because it seems like I've not come across any robo katana people. I've just got up to the upper deck or the upper deck, some sort of posher area. I literally just got there.
Oh, that's nice.
My last thing.
It's nice up there.
So that's okay. I'm not going to make. I'm just not going to continue to be nice now. I'm up there, is it?
Get to just blow up nicer looking things. It all looks nice though. I love a really mucky place that's rendered all modern kind of graphical bells and whistles. Something very appealing about it. The dirtier and more reflective a thing is, the more it kind of, I don't know, shows off your hardware somehow. I don't know. It's a strange effect.
Well, do you like that place that was partially submerged?
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Like the kind of shifting, rippling textures of things.
Yeah.
But particularly like being in a place where you can see cities in the background. That's the good stuff.
Yeah. What do you think about the cyberdecky, not cyberdecky things, you know, the kind of your upgrades, your abilities?
I don't feel like I've had a chance to experiment them properly yet, even if a few hours in. I just sort of spend things willy-nilly and I've actually kind of, I don't feel like that system is unlocked for me. You know, the one where you sort of press C and air of effect kind of cyber hack thing happens.
Yeah.
I feel like there must be like there's a whole system there I've not actually kind of encountered properly yet in the game.
Yeah, it's not really been fully very, I haven't really done anything. I've opened a few doors with it. And that's
right. Well, almost every door just goes no. And I was like, well, I'll never press that button. Never press that button again, though, I suppose. But I'm sure that maybe there are kind of builds that you can spec towards that might actually make that more useful. I think like I've hit it. If I hit it around enemies, it might give me some sort of bonus to hit or something. Again, like I think all the systems could be a bit better communicated. I think the urge just to have symbols for everything is kind of can be nice when you're looking at weapons at a glance and saying, "Oh, it does triangle. That's cool." but there is a period where you just have to kind of translate everything and learn what everything is.
Which is often the kind of the cyberpunk thing because the writing is like, "Oh, you've got to jack into the." Thing deck and all that.
Yeah, the writing's
and the language.
This kind of writing, the dialogue is kind of has been an interesting mix of stuff. There's a real love of words in there somewhere where people love to mash together like really strange terms, like slum bucket or something. Or I wish I'd written some down actually because there's been some quite funny just turns of phrase. Everyone is just British for some reason. cool, I guess, but that is hearing sort of. A guy that kind of looks like a giant cross between an octopus and a rhino, just kind of half drunk in a bar, talking about slum buckets. It's really quite likable about it, actually. Quite enjoy it, even though it's quite.
And there's a lot of dialogue. They want to do a lot of story in this, like quite part. You know, they call the sort of details of corporations that are over the place, but there's a lot of dialogue. There's all these incidental things as well.
There are lots of. Little side quests and things, which I've really, really not been bothered to do. It's great when you have like loads and loads of stats and loads of gritty kind of systems like that, and then also loads of dialogue. But it's very much the pleasure of the game is about going up and shooting a thing at point blank range. And so I kind of want to do that and haven't just kind of put the homework in. It feels like there's some homework I need to do with this game to actually get into its systems and see if it works properly. So maybe I'll report back once I've shot my way up to even more beautiful levels.
There was I was just going to say about on that beauty thing. Like, I've never played a top-down game like this that's been able to pull off a cutscene, just, you know, seamlessly going into a cutscene that's in kind of third person on the level and it looking good.
Like, it's really true.
All the game could be down on there. Like,
yes,
probably not. But and then you know, you're seeing the super. Did you admire his skin?
Yeah,
he's got the super skin.
Yeah,
it's beautifully translucently kind of waxy alien skin. It's amazing with these little nubbins that kind of stick up, and they're kind of sort of a little bit, I don't know, angry looking, and the way that the light comes off them. God, blimey.
Yeah. I get fascinated by so many details in this game. So you, often when you're talking to your super, he's sitting opposite you in a booth in a bar behind just the most enormous bong. And it's just the most like incredible over-designed cyberpunk bong you've ever seen. Or maybe it's supposed to be like a shisha pipe or something. But I'm just, every time I'm not really listening to what's going on. It's like, how do you even use that thing, man? It's kind of getting, it's in between. Like, no one can make eye contact across the table because the thing is there demanding attention. So someone's really just got to loads of care just for this one piece of incidental scenery. That level of detail is just present throughout the entire thing, as far as I can tell. It's wonderful. So, Neon Giant is the developer. So
Neon Giant.
Yeah, Curve Digital publisher. So stuff.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see how long it stays, like how it can, as you were saying, sort of how it can kind of build on all this, because it's been really fun for 3 hours or so, and I'd like it to stay fun for longer.
Yeah, I wonder what it's like co-op as well. I think you can from up to four people maybe ish probably check that, but I was impressed. I have had a really nice time with it so far. I'd wonder how much of that, also I really like the armor as well. The armor's just scrappy enough and kind of interesting enough. I love it when games model loads of different armor looks, because it makes me really excited to equip new stuff when I look different.
Yeah, particularly as you don't know what the hell it's going to actually do for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. At least it looks cool, right? That's the cyberpunk ethic.
Really. Yeah, I was very pleased to see the kind of the ones that I'd kind of accidentally just, I don't know, worn. They did go well together, like a nice red top with a pair of very kind of... tight-bottomed but baggy-legged red and white trousers.
Nice. No, that's very good. Have you been playing anything else, Alex?
It's been a bit scrappy lately, but mostly because I've been a few weeks ago, maybe a few months ago, I talked about playing Mushihime Sama, which is a cave shmup based on shooting bugs.
Yeah.
Being a bug and shooting bugs. And it's very, very, very good. It's on the PC in a very good port of its 360 port. And it's just a good game, which I've failed to get much better at, which is pretty bad because I still can't really get on one credit more than about two levels in. But I'm enjoying it, and it's the ride that counts, isn't it? Rather than the result.
Absolutely.
Part of the reason why I have not gotten better at it is that I've kind of broken the cardinal rule of shmups, which I've interpreted as being pick a shmup and fucking stick to it. Because these are games that are just fantastically complicated and about learning, like a mixture of rote learning and kind of divining courses through it and understanding scoring systems and just developing the right sort of threat instinct, I suppose, and just general eye-hand coordination and all these other things. And these are sort of, I suppose, the proper name would be manic shooters, but bullet hells, where the screen is filled with bullets, and quite a lot of the time, your task is to understand a way to survive within them and tools to reduce their kind of threat to you. And Mushihime Sama is a really good game to learn on, you know, the way it does that kind of thing. But I keep playing other games and I'm kind of kicking myself, really. But because they distract me and I kind of don't really go very deep into them, and I'm kind of intrigued by the next. I've also been playing another classic called Strikers 1945 2. There are several in the series, but 2 is kind of meant to be one of the good ones.
I like the idea that a year can have a sequel.
Yeah.
I do enjoy that.
Let's do that again. There is a 3 as well. So they did it again.
Trilogy. 1945. Cool.
And that one is a kind of an older, oh, is it older than Machine in Time? It must be. Yeah, it must be. And it's sort of just, it's by a different developer. Like the developers all had particular takes and styles and kind of interpretations of what you can do in a modern, or at the time modern. These are all mostly came from the 90s, from between sort of early to about 2001 or two, I suppose, is the kind of time that all these games I've been sort of mucking around with have been coming from. Played Raiden 4. Which is like Raiden is one of the all-time classics, one of the kind of archetypal shmups, and Raiden 4 is kind of a good one, sort of reasonably recent one. Chōrenshā, which is a doujin shooter. I think it came out in 1990-something. I can't remember the developer who made it, but if they were produced it for a computer. Oh, I can't remember what the name of the computer is now, but yeah, this is like a much scrappier looking, but just very fun, fast-moving shooter where the background scrolls really fast and gives this sort of sense of real dynamism. And it, like on my screen, it blows up very, very big because the port to Windows 10 is kind of pretty bare bones to the extent that I have to use Joy to Key to get my arcade stick to map up to it. But it is so fast and it is incredibly fun. In that one, I've got to level 2, which is pretty good. I got distracted by Dodonpachi Resurrection, which is also on PC. All these games are on PC. The Dodonpachi Resurrection, which is one of the many versions of Dodonpachi, which is another cave game, makers of Mishima Sama as well. They've made, I don't know enough to know exactly how they all map together and how, like, which one is in which order. And Resurrection is actually called a different name in Japan. And so when you're reading about them, you may well be reading about Resurrection and you can play it because it's on Steam. I'm bad at that, but it is very fun. What I'm hoping to get from all this is kind of, I want to learn them a bit, but also just to understand kind of a lot of where a very kind of very specific form of game design, kind of how it works, like what makes a good one. Like when people say Raiden 4 is good, like why? I don't really know on a personal level why yet. Like I don't know. I can tell you why Dodonpachi Resurrection is a better game in many people's eyes than the first Dodonpachi, because they are very, very similar and there are sort of obvious differences, but I don't know how to qualitatively kind of tell you why one is better than the other. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do. Mm. Maybe I'll continue to talk about them as I kind of not be very good at them.
But they feel like a sort of a hobby unto themselves. It's that kind of genre, isn't it? Where there's just so much nuance ostensibly at a glance looks like a simple game about avoiding bullets. Like they all have such kind of interesting twists on scoring systems and just kind of different attitudes to how you defend yourself. Like as you say, the illusion is that you're blowing loads of stuff up, but actually like that's a way of just staving off the bullets, off the amount of stuff on the screen you have to deal with.
Yeah, and it's kind of really nice. So Dodonpachi is just really interesting because that one, the scoring mechanism is one where you've got to keep hitting stuff, because as soon as you stop hitting stuff, a little timer which is located in the top left corner of the screen goes down, and it goes down very quickly. And so you need to be chaining these kills, chaining, keep going. And there are ways through every stage that you can keep chaining, keep hitting stuff. And that often means not deploying your best guns. Like you kind of want to tone down damage because you want to be scoring hits on something so that an enemy is still on screen by the time replenished enemies appear at the top. So there's that, all of that happening at the same time as just trying to stay alive, which is definitely the bit that I'm still struggling with. The idea of chaining the first level of Dodonpachi is still way beyond me. Mm. And I've seen videos about how to do this, and you look at them and the player is effortlessly just lazily doing these figures of eight from left to right, you know, and on the way as they're doing it, they're just picking up kind of these sort of pickups off the ground, left by enemies. And it looks effortless and beautiful. And when I do it, and they're saying, now look out for this enemy, and this means that you can now go to the left. It's a lot to remember, obviously, but it's not even a matter of remembering. Like, I don't have the eye hand coordination, because you see the delicacy with which they're moving the ships. Like, and this goes for any of these shooters. You watch in good hands just the way that they move. And, you know, these are very specifically, like, these shooters that you play them with a digital controller. Like, you're either moving up or you're moving down.
Yeah.
It's rarely any acceleration to them. You know, there's definitely no analog control, and there's no acceleration to their movement. So to get the fine placing of positioning, because, you know, famously your hitbox is tiny, so you can fit into very small spaces in a lot of these games. I cannot achieve that delicacy at all.
Especially when you see,
again, I want to try it.
Yeah, so when people start, because a lot of the times many of these games you play two players in co-op. It's when one player just plays with two ships, one hand on each stick.
Yeah, like, yeah.
I just say, sometimes I see people doing things like, how are humans capable of this, and why? Why is a human able to do this? Incredibly complex, fine motor skill. It feels like we've used games to push ourselves to be very, very good at things that, it's like, the natural world doesn't require this level of any of this. Like, this is an entirely human thing we've invented for ourselves, which is kind of weirdly inspiring. I don't know why. I guess watching the Olympics is like that as well. Just people have dedicated huge amounts of time to be able to do one thing that.
I remember an argument that I had with Marsh a long, long time ago, probably 10 years ago now. It was a good-natured argument, of course, in which it was at the point where Guitar Hero was big. I think maybe in around the first game, like, he'd been out for a good while by that point. And all those videos were starting to come out of those skill plays of, you know, the hardest level and somebody playing.
Was it
just
like a, why not just learn the instrument type debate?
it was that argument. Yeah. It was that argument. You know, this is a colossal waste of time at this point. I don't think that he was saying, you know, you should, you know, it was like, this is depressing.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
And I was arguing that, like, I don't know what I was arguing, because I basically do agree with him while also really admiring it and kind of hoping that these skills are transferable into, you know. But then again, why can't you be? And in a world of, you know, why can't you just have a laugh, eh?
Why not?
Why do we have to learn skills that
are transferable? It makes us more productive in the marketplace.
Be productive in the multiplayer. Yes. They probably did show anyone that video at a job interview, and like, fucking hell, yeah, you got the job.
Well, it's interesting. I've been getting back into chess recently, and the chess world is like super. I find it super interesting. I've been listening to like a chess podcast and watching. There's some brilliant YouTubers and streamers for chess as well, who make it really accessible and funny, while also just clearly used to being on international master plus level. But one of the interesting things that comes out of interviews with people who are very good at chess is they say, well, there aren't really any transferable skills to this. I'm just really good at chess. Being good at chess means you're really good at chess. But some of them have said is that actually it has gotten them jobs, because there's a cultural cachet to being good at chess. But that's culturally defined, right? So being extremely good at twin stick arcade shooters just doesn't have the same level of admiration attached to it. And also maybe like, I mean, chess being hundreds of years old, and also just, I don't know, being connected to a kind of intellectual elitism, perhaps, in some ways, the way it's been portrayed. Also, the fact that it's also been, I think, co-opted by states like America versus Russia and stuff like that. So it's taken on international significance throughout his lifetime, and that gives it a kind of weight that unfortunately Ikaruga doesn't have. but you know, maybe is that a matter of just kind of cultural context rather than the skill set involved in being good at the thing. Those two sadly don't operate independently, like they're always tied together, I think, but that does make them more fascinating.
I do wonder when, or it might be at this point already, but like, you know, there is a generation now that has grown up entirely around modern style games, you know, that started to play games with games that resemble what they are today, as opposed to like certainly my generation, which grew up with games that don't look a lot like the games of today. And the other generation is normalized to those and maybe does have appreciate them on a different level that to the ones that sort of appreciated them and, you know, or didn't appreciate them when I was kind of going into the workplace, you know.
Yeah.
You'd never tell anyone that you played video games as a hobby. But I wonder whether people might now, you know, in the right place and things.
Yeah, I wonder about that, particularly because with the rise of like MMOs and the internet, like be able to find a hobby group that gets, or a competitive group that gets super, super into a game, I think it means that, so terms like, oh, a DPS check in an MMO room where, you know, you just, oh, it's a kit check to make sure that you're doing enough damage per second to actually be able to survive the encounter. Like, that's just common terminology in a lot of communities now. And that's actually quite a technical bit of game design theory to know, just to play a game. And that's magnified tenfold when you look at, as you know, StarCraft 2 builds or Dota 2 competitions and things like that. So maybe there's a kind of degree of design literacy that might be raised overall by the prevalence of games. These deeply intensely competitive games, combined with the size of the community and the quality level of the people involved, in terms of how good they get at those games and how much they obsess over the games and share their knowledge. It's potentially pretty remarkable. And if you grow up in that universe, then maybe one day chess will look pretty tame. Even though it is balls hard. So I'm learning, I'm terrible at it.
I think that even now you could say, hey, I ran a guild, and you know, the interviewer might say, a guild? And you'd say, oh, well, you know, I played, you know, at a high level in an MMO, and my guild was 500 people, and I ran it, which meant this and that. And, you know, these are easily recognizable skills that any non-gamer would appreciate and kind of shit, you know, 500 people. That's a serious kind of achievement. And that's fairly run of the mill by gaming standards.
Yeah, right.
Have you been playing anything else?
I've been playing. I've been playing a bit of Zelda, Alex. And I love a bit of Zelda. It's what I've discovered. It's just so delightfully calming in a way that I completely forgot about. And so I've been playing. This isn't on PC, obviously, but Zelda has just influenced so much stuff that I think just a good Zelda game is worth talking about. And so I've been playing Skyward Sword, which was re-released on Switch.
Have you? I thought, because when you said it was calming, I thought, oh, you're out on the fields in Breath of the Wild with that piano sting playing.
I mean, just feeling don't good. Get me wrong, I get that kick 10 times over with Breath of the Wild. I absolutely love that game. It's a lovely place to be as well. There's something like, so Skyward Sword was released on Wii, I think, so there's a lot of motion controls with the they've had to design out of the game, but that is very elegantly done. Mostly that's just tied to the movements of the right stick now, so it's gestures on the right stick.
Have they completely removed it? Because you can't, like, the nunchucks, they are entirely,
you can play that way,
aren't they? Right. But you wouldn't.
Well, no, I wouldn't personally. But then I've been playing it a lot just on the couch, not looking at, just like lying down on the couch with the Switch above my head, just kind of playing with it on the sticks rather than with the motion controls. The motion controls aren't bad on the Switch, but I don't think they're designed to point at the screen in the same way, so it feels a bit different. Though I guess a lot of the sword swings and stuff are quite, you know, do map one-to-one with the Switch controls. I think the thing I like about Skyward Sword is that it's beautifully chunked up and paced from area to area. The drip feed of new gadget it gives you from place to place, and that combined with just very I think just little flourishes that hit some sort of lowest common denominator joy that in most people. And in this one, that is the presence of a harp. There's always a musical instrument of some sort in lots of the modern Zelda games. So I think it was, what was it? Pipe in the N64 one.
Ocarina, for goodness sake, it's in the title.
It's the name of the game. God's sake, Tom. Me. Come on. The Ocarina of Time. So you play that. I think for many people, Ocarina is one of the first things I ever played as an instrument, which is unfortunate.
Did you?
Because it's a piece of crap if you don't know what you're doing, and I've never encountered anyone.
It looks a uniquely awkward thing to play, actually.
Yeah. It's either that or a recorder, and I would actually
How do you even hold that thing?
I know, yeah. It's like something designed for human hands, like it's a shell thing. And it actually just sounds like a kind of squealy thing that you're murdering. But great, if you translate that into button presses to kind of go back to the Guitar Hero thing, to give you a sense of at least a minor bit of involvement, while even just kind of like a low bit, but beautifully toned melody, very simple childlike melody plays. And the great trick that Zelda plays is that you play a kind of naked version of it that sounds rubbish. But if you play it in the right place to unlock something, suddenly the score kicks in and the camera spins around. And this one, the spirit that inhabits your sword pops out and starts dancing across the walls. And it's like, oh, I'm in the mainframe now. I'm touching God. This is awesome. I'm becoming one with the dungeon. This is amazing. And these just kind of just beautiful, weirdly transcendental moments in a game that's fundamentally just a game about kind of find the object, use the object on the object-shaped things in the environment. The hookshot, you get the hookshot, and suddenly there are these just literally giant targets all over the walls. You just point at the targets and press them.
Recognize the thing that causes you to press button C.
Button thing, and then do button thing, and then somehow be delighted by it, like every time, which I think comes down to just a lot of just small little animation bits or responsiveness, the way that when you point your hookshot, it goes into first person, and the sort of motion controls on the Switch are really nice in first person. They're really sensitive, so you can actually look around, and that's quite immersive. Then you hit the hookshot, and third person zoom directly towards it without any wind-up animation, so it feels really immediate, and you just click to it. It's almost like a magnet snapping in, and then you can turn around and shoot it at something else from that perspective, from that point of view. It's just really fun and tactile and good to use every single time, and then it drops it at the end of the dungeon, and then you get a bow that does something else. It's just, that's enough. I think, like, when that's done so well and married with also this, there's something very again storybook about Zelda. It's just some person in a green suit, and there's probably, you know, there's various villains, and there's a sword, there's the Triforce, and they're all kind of like the powers that you need to defeat Ganon, Calamity Ganon, whoever it might be, are just kind of always... It's going to be Ganon, isn't it? It's all predictably sprinkled out across these different areas that open up to you. And occasionally you get a song. And I don't know. I think it's as simple as that. I really do. Like, every time I get the same little bit of just calming, lovely joy from Zelda.
I think there's something... I think it's an unsung thing, the idea of a structure being so sort of known, and that the art comes in remixing stuff within that. So nothing happens that you don't expect, but it all happens within that expectation in an interesting way. Like, it's just playing with familiarity and novelty, just in this kind of, and not many games really put it off. And I do wonder whether, going back to the sort of some of the shooter stuff, you know, these, you know, to the outside view, these games look identical. You know, they're all doing the same thing. Oh, all you're doing is going fast, you know, up the screen and shooting stuff. And it's finding those tiny little sort of frictions between novelty and familiarity that kind of where the kind of magic happens.
Yeah, there's something about... I wonder to what extent, for example, Zelda's structure, which to me just seems innate? Is it because I've grew up playing games? I wonder if like, or if there's something about chunking up the information it delivers that is just satisfying to humans more generally. Like it's hit upon a kind of a learning curve that is just very, very palatable to most people who actually interact with it. And that combined with the kind of the lack of edginess or violence and the simplicity of its hero themes just makes it highly snackable and deeply inoffensive. And also, I think you'd give to your kids quite happily. Like it just wraps a lot of things into one extremely nice thing.
Yeah. How do you, after having played Breath of the Wild, like I think this Skyward Sword was really interesting because it does seem quite sort of, because, you know, I was just sort of talking about how the Zelda is a very formulaic thing, but then Breath of the Wild really does break that formula to an enormous extent.
It also it
completely tears out the kind of the guts of it.
It does.
Skyward Sword is definitely a strong stepping stone towards it in many ways.
Yeah, it is. Even down to just the way the stamina bar is used in Skyward Sword to limit your traversal options until like you can buy stamina potions in.
Because you have quite a lot of freedom within an area, haven't you?
Yes.
Out of that relatively era.
Yeah, relatively. So there's a whole desert area, for example, that's actually pretty massive. And you discover more about the area that helps you to traverse it more effectively, which I won't spoil because it's part of the fun of actually unlocking the area. And it's also you get sent back to former areas, so they become almost living spaces that change as you get more gadgets or unlock bits of knowledge about how pathways work in the area that might help, you know, let you explore new places. So and in between those areas you're also going back into the sky to your sky town, which is like a hub, and there are kind of little mini quests and things like that in there, which also feels it's something you do in other Zelda games, but it feels a bit more kind of like a hub and spoke structure. Whereas Breath of the Wild, I think the thing that defines Breath of the Wild isn't just the fact that it is this sprawling open world location. I think it demands a lot more of the player in terms of being creative with its tools to surmount. So it's more of a sandbox challenge rather than a kind of click on the thing with the thing challenge in a lot of areas. And that's kind of what, for the upper limits of player creativity, you see these amazing YouTube videos of people using the powers to kind of freeze a rock in space and then hit it loads of times to create momentum and then send it over a mountain to crush a goblin or something like that. And which is really funny and amazing. And it's great that that's it, you know, possible in the game. But it was a very brave thing to do that and still have players like who loved Zelda as a, you know, Ocarina of Time as a kid and want that kind of structure and perhaps don't get it in the same way from Breath of the Wild because it's more variation in how long it takes each player to sort of process those tools and use them in different areas. And obviously that game was universally praised, but I don't feel like you hear much about perhaps the struggles people have had with the game, I wonder. And I wonder this particularly because I love open world games and open world sandboxes, but I've got friends who just really dislike them because they just don't know what to do or how to, they don't know, they constantly have this anxiety where they think they're doing the wrong thing by going in a direction. What am I meant to be doing? Is this right? Am I putting time towards nothing if I try and do this? And that's definitely like a player type. And I wonder if Breath of the Wild kind of does create that anxiety. I'm not sure. I love it though.
I think it guides you more than a lot of them, or some of them anyway.
Yeah, but just to be able to climb anything, and the game being so the first variation of the game, like I thought that was kind of amazing. I was like, wow,
yeah, for sure.
I might be able to get anywhere. I want to get to a high vantage point so I can see where everything is. But maybe that's like actually quite a lot to ask from, you know, players, or maybe especially young players might be picking it up. But I don't know. That's an assumption. Do like Skyward Sword though.
I'm glad it's having this kind of second go because it was fairly roundly kind of criticised when it came out. Like it came had a lot of good reviews. My magazine gave it a 10. And
I remember getting a few like
it got a bit sevens. Of a drubbing over time. Yeah.
So, do you remember what people like? What sort of stood out as criticisms of it? Because I was trying to figure out what they might have been actually. And I've been playing.
I think that there was some. Lots of Nintendo kind of hand-wringing kind of "Ooh, you picked up a rupee every time you 5 rupees. This lets you buy stuff. Oh, you've picked up a nut. The nut makes you do stuff." Like every time you pick them up, and you have had interminable kind of things like that. The motion controls, I think, were not relished very much. I think the dungeon design was generally received well, but I think also I think that the idea of an open world was really starting to break out at that point, you know, and there's an expectation that, because like the Zelda games, particularly from Ocarina of Time on, they sold an idea of open big areas, and like Hyrule Field was big at the time. But it was tiny. And like Twilight Princess sort of had similar sort of largish areas, but sort of you really did feel quite quickly that they were quite constrained. And I think people had really started to develop a kind of, you know, this is meant to be big, huh? Because we're meant to be up in the sky and the skies are big. So this game should be big. But it actually devolved into, you know, the same old kind of, you're going to a specific little kind of roped off area.
Yeah.
And you're in here and then you'll find your way to the next area. And, you know, just like as old as it always had been. So I think there's a bit of disappointment about that as well.
Yeah. It might have tied into the way the Wii was kind of perceived as being the weakest console, perhaps one of the, just in terms of processing power, one of the compared to other consoles in the generation.
It was
by quite a long way.
Yeah, it's way behind.
But I mean, that has not mattered to me at all with the Switch, for example. But then the Switch can do those huge, expensive experiences that other consoles can do as well. And I don't need everything to look like Horizon Zero Dawn. If it looks like Breath of the Wild, then I love that. That's fine.
But it's the Nintendo. I've always thought it looked good.
Yeah.
But I think that today we can appreciate it for what it is, as opposed to what it wasn't at the time.
Right. Yeah.
Where we were wanting it to be kind of big and open. These days, okay. Well, I'll play Breath of the Wild then, or Far Cry 5.
Yeah.
Take your pick.
Yeah. That's true. What a breadth of experience we have. One of the things I wanted to get into, I'm not going to do it yet, but I thought I'd announce it on the pod, so I could potentially get some kind of suggestions from listeners. But I really want to get back into light gun games. I don't know quite how. I think I'm going to pick...
What are your games?
Light gun games. Remember those?
No way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
There's actually loads of them on PC, but not really.
How do you play them?
Well, exactly. I think I'm going to pick up, there's a really highly rated thing called the Sinden light gun, which is an Indiegogo creation that lets you apparently use it as a light gun for CRTs, for modern monitors, rather than, you know, the old television screens. And I was like, I'm going to give it a shot, and I'll report back depending on whether it works. So I'll be playing House.
I'm excited.
Get hold of Time Crisis somehow, you know, all the classic stuff. And yeah, I've just got a real hankering for it, and I really liked light gun games, and they just sort of suddenly disappeared.
It's once the CRTs went.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare trying to get them to work with modern displays.
If this thing works, I'll let everyone know. If it doesn't, if anyone's got any suggestions as to how to do it, I'm all ears.
Is it called the Sinden because of Donald Sinden?
I've no idea.
I'm hoping it is.
Who's Donald Sinden?
He's a very mellifluously kind of voiced British actor of the 1970s would be his heyday, I would say.
Awesome. Hopefully it's every time you reload it speaks with his voice. That'd be amazing. Yeah, that's my next retro adventure.
Awesome. And that's all we have time for this time. Thanks for listening at home. I always do that. Thanks for listening, everybody. We do that at the end, don't we, Tom?
You don't have to. It's not the law.
Well, yeah, it doesn't flow very well. I've already made it not flow very well.
You know what I was about to say? You know what makes it not flow well?
Yeah, me moaning about it flowing
so, badly. That's a good hour of takes. I'm going to play loads more stuff for the next one. Back on the video game train. Feeling good.
Including light gun games.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. Very excited about that.
You can hang out with us and our community on our Discord channel, which is lovely, filled with lovely people, and lovely discussions. You can find the link for our Discord at our website, creightoncrowbar.com. If you have a question for a future episode, or you have some gen to give to Tom about light gun gaming on the modern PC platform,
yes, please.
Email us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can tweet at us at creightoncrowbar. You can listen to the show on YouTube, where you'll find our various spin-off projects and shows and things. The Creighton Crowbar is kindly funded by our Patreon backers. If you'd like to know more about supporting our podcast and all its spin-offs, you can find the address on our website, but I'll tell you to you direct here. It's patreon.com/, you guessed it, Creighton Crowbar. And that is it. That is it.
Hooray.
Can I say the words that I so desperately want to say now, Tom?
Yes. Now is the time.
Thanks for listening, everybody.